you are standing and expressing this is both an incredibly dangerous moment in American history, but also an amazingly possible moment. When it's white folks in pain, we understand there are systemic causes. When it's black and brown folks in pain, we ignore the system and we focus on the individual and we blame them because we lack radical empathy.
You have to say black lives matter rather than all lives matter, because we said all men are created equal, endowed by their creator with certain inalienable rights. We said all, but we didn't mean all.
The whole history of America is the history of rich white men telling working class white people that their enemies are black and brown.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise, a project of Speak Out, the nation's premier nonprofit speakers bureau, which for over 25 years has been bringing educators and activists to campuses and communities across America to engage in meaningful dialogue about the pressing issues that confront our country and the world. If you enjoy the program, one way you can express your support is to become a monthly patron and sustainer of the show by signing up at www.patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. You can pledge as little as $2 a month or as much as you'd like, and not only know that you're supporting our efforts, but also gain access to bonus content, like premium commentaries on the events of the week, as well as signed books or DVDs. And all donations are tax deductible as they go directly to Speak Out to support their nonprofit activist mission. You can also make a one-time donation to the program at speakoutnow.org via PayPal, make sure to subscribe to the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcast. Hello and welcome to another episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. I am your host, Tim Wise, and I want to welcome folks back to the program after several weeks, actually a couple of months, where I wasn't doing interview shows with guests. I've been putting out episodes every other week, essentially with me doing an extended commentary on one or another issue that's, you know, prevalent in the news. Did a couple of episodes where I stitched together previous premium commentaries that are over on my Patreon page at patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise, and did that to sort of fill the summer, give myself a little time off from doing the research and the interviewing. But now, back in the swing of things, we'll be having today a program that I think you're going to enjoy. I'm going to be talking with David Camp about the issue of racial dialogues, how to do them, why to do them, when to do them. He has just put together a fantastic new resource, the White Ally Toolkit Workbook, which you will find out more about today on the program. He is a man of color, black man who's trying to help white folks figure out how to talk to one another about the issue of racism and challenge one another around the issue of racism and white supremacy, because he knows that it's not his job, and he knows that black and brown folks generally don't want to have to be the ones who solve our problems for us. So he's trying to help us white folks figure out how to speak to one another, and I think he's done a fantastic job with this new workbook. Enjoy today's program. Again, a conversation with David Camp about the issue of racial dialogues and the White Ally Toolkit Workbook. So enjoy the program and hope that you'll become a regular listener. If you have been a regular listener all this time, tell your friends and family, spread the word about the program. And if you want some bonus content, go over to patreon.com/speakoutwithtimwise. You can become a patron and sustainer of the show for $2, $5, $10, $20, whatever you'd like to offer. You get some extra commentary, some bonus commentaries that aren't available anywhere else, as well as additional goodies at patreon.com. My guest today is Dr. David Camp. With more than 25 years of professional experience, Dr. Camp, who you can find on Twitter at The Dialogue Guy, is considered a national expert in the areas of inclusion and equity, cultural competence, and intergroup dialogue. His insights about the keys to more inclusive and effective institutions and communities have been sought by small executive boards of fewer than a dozen to large-scale summits involving thousands of people. His clients have varied widely and have included the United States military, the White House, large corporations, international organizations, foundations, governments, universities, national associations, and nonprofit groups. David is the author of two books about dialogue, The Little Book of Dialogue for for Difficult Subjects, which was released in 2007, and Read the Room for Real, How a Simple Technology Creates Better Meetings, released in 2015. In early 2016, he created a project called the Ally Conversation Toolkit, which has engaged thousands of people in person and online. The featured product of the Ally Conversation Toolkit is the White Ally Toolkit Workbook, which features 300 pages of exercise, guidance, and coaching, and scientific findings that encourage and equip anti-racism allies to be more effective when talking to people who deny the existence and the problem of racism. It is available at www.allyconversationtoolkit.com. Well, David, thank you for joining me on the program. It's been a pretty long time since we spoke. We met one another about 20 years ago, I'm guessing. We were both involved with the Race Relations Institute at Fisk University here in Nashville, and we met at that time. So it's been probably a good 20 years or close to it since we last spoke. Tell people a little bit about your work, and especially as it relates to the work that led you to believe that we needed to have something like what you've created here, this White Anti-Racist Ally Toolkit and a workbook for that purpose. And before you answer what led you to believe that was an important tool, take me back to those days last time I was speaking to you, because I believe that if I have this correct, you were on the staff of the President's Initiative, and by President now, I mean President Clinton. President Clinton's Initiative on Race, which was, as I recall, a sort of semi-aborted effort at encouraging national dialogue on race. What, if any, relationship was there between the work that you did there and your coming to a recognition that we really needed better tools for dialogue around race, and particularly for white folks to use in encouraging and having some of that dialogue?
That is correct. Yeah, I was with the President's Initiative on Race. I was the one person out of 40 who knew anything about dialogue, even though one of the main projects of the initiative was dialogue. So
right.
That's a little bit of irrationality in how that was structured.
What were some of the aspects of that experience that perhaps led you to the realization that we really needed to have better tools for engaging, particularly white folks, around the issue of race in constructive dialogue? What were some of the lessons that you took away from that experience?
So I'll go back a little bit before that. So basically, the quickie bio sketch is I grew up in Detroit and old enough to have been alive for the 67 riots, but I not really remember. My mom tells me I hid under the bed when the tanks were rolling around the neighborhood. But I certainly remember all the tumult of the 1970s in Detroit and then the tremendous white flight that was happening. And so I'm noticing the level of conflict on the news in the city around who gets to run the city. And also I'm noticing that my neighborhood was changing dramatically. We, in about 10 years, we moved to a place where when we got there, it was maybe three black families in a large area. And by the time, 10 years later, it was 50% black. That's a huge level of white flight. So I became intrigued about this question, the question of who's in power and what is the sort of racial or cultural implications of that and what difference does it actually make? So then I think I left Detroit in 1978, go to college. I go to Princeton and then I go to Berkeley after some time working in New York, and I'm studying issues around cultural competence. My first degree was in public policy, second degree was city planning. And I'm still looking at this question of who controls the apparatus of government and why does that matter? So when I finished my PhD, and I went to the White House to work for the Race Initiative. I'd done some amount of racial dialogue work as a grad student. And there, I mean, even though dialogue was supposed to be one of the most important things that the initiative did, the Clinton Race Initiative did, nobody thinks that dialogue is a skill. People think it's just, hey, just have people talk. And of course, dialogue is more complex than that. If you're trying to set up dialogues around difficult topics, you have to establish some sort of reasonable dialogic frame. And you have to invite people to it and make sure it's facilitated well at the minimum. And so I was tasked to think about how the initiative, this national initiative with White House prestige, would promote that. So I was the lead staff person on a project where we used some outside consultants to think about what's a presidential dialogue guide, a guide that's supposed to be helpful if it's five guys sitting around after the Super Bowl or men and women, or if it's a town hall meeting, what is a dialogue guide that would help us discuss race that would be helpful in both of those settings, right? And then I also had the task of trying to get the goodwill that Clinton had, certainly in the middle and on the left, to get some multi-stick dialogue initiatives going. So I was the person going out there trying to do that. So part of what I became intrigued by is this question of what does it mean to take dialogue to scale? How do you think about what are conversational frames that are sort of focused enough where you can, you're having a real conversation that's not surface and not letting people easily hide behind the I'm colorblind, everybody should be, or we all need to treat each other fairly, which is something that people can say from if they're on the far left and have a deep analysis of racial issues. And they also could say that if they're on the right. The question becomes, how do you raise questions to get people past that so they can have a real conversation about our racial predicament? So this issue of how you set up a conversational frame, a dialogic frame, became very intriguing to me. And so I still believe deeply in the power of dialogue to transform people. I just have recognized after the election that while we need to figure out how to put people in rooms at a big scale and have these kind of cross-racial interactions, if we're really going to shift a lot of white people's views, it's not going to be from people getting in rooms. We got to have white people talking to white people. There's no people of color there. So that's what created the toolkit.
Well, you know, it strikes me that that's always been sort of the problem when it comes to dialogue and how we think about racial dialogue. The assumption is that we need to get a lot of people together and scale it up for these really large rooms or a lot of maybe medium-sized rooms all around the country. And there have certainly been a lot of dialogue initiatives like that, some of them more effective than others. And although that can be fantastic, it can also be very hard to get together. It takes a lot of planning. It takes some resources, some money. And even if you have dozens of them, hundreds of them, maybe even thousands of them, there's a real question as to how many people you really reach. I mean, I think about that even as someone who goes around and gives talks all year long. You know, if I do 80 talks a year, which is really more than I'm doing nowadays, but if I do 80 talks a year, even if I had 1,000 people in every room, and I don't, that would be 80,000 people a year that might actually be privy to whatever information on race I'm going to be giving them, which I mean, I guess is fine. And yes, some people will see it on YouTube because somebody will videotape it and that'll get the numbers up. But let's be honest, that's not really going to move the needle at a national level. And the same thing is true with dialogue. In fact, it's even more true because you could have 1,000 of those dialogue events. You'd still only be talking about a pretty small percentage of the overall national population. It seems to me that we have got to develop these dialogue tools, not for the macro level, which is understandable that we want to go there. We want to have a big impact. That's what social justice folks are about. We're about social change. We don't want to think small. We want to think big. And yet at the same time, a lot of these skills that we need that it seems that you're aware of and that you're talking about in this toolkit are skills that people can use on a day-to-day that literally millions of people could deploy in their residence halls, in their places of work, around the Thanksgiving table, you know, when you're talking to people at a community event or a block party, or, you know, you got people over at, or you're at a cocktail bar, whatever it is, all the different rooms that we find ourselves in that maybe are not intentionally set up for the purpose of this dialogue, but where this kind of thing comes up. We need those kinds of day-to-day skills, and maybe that's where we need to be focusing, is less on the macro and more on the micro. Is that what I hear you saying?
That is exactly right. I'm a member of something called the National Coalition of Dialogue and Deliberation. It's kind of like a facilitator nerd group. And certainly people in that world have noticed the increasing partisanship and divide and the way that people on different ideologies see each other as enemies much more now than they did in the past. You've heard that statistic where 50 years ago, like 60-70% of people, they wouldn't mind their child marrying somebody of a different party, but they didn't want to marry some different race. Now that has flipped.
Right.
So people in the dialogue world have been concerned about this for years. But I think that the solutions have often been, just as you said, like, how do we get people in rooms to teach them things? And that, you know, there's a value in that. Creating those rooms where people can have interactions with people who are very different than them is a important thing that I think as a society we have underinvested in. And it is also true that if we're going to really try to move the society forward or on those divisions, those ideological divisions, much less racial divisions, we have to figure out a way to propagate those skills through the population. If what we're talking about is a largely a conversation between progressives and conservatives. And that's largely what it is.
Yeah.
Yes, there are many people who are progressive who have racially backward views. And there's some people who are conservative who have more racially forward views. But as a general matter, this is a conservative liberal conversation. We also have to, not only do we have to teach skills of dialogue generally, but we also have to train people who are progressive people and trying to have these conversations with Uncle Bubba. They need to figure out how to raise issues in a way that's different than they raise them with their other woke friends. And as you'll see, as you get more into my book, The White Ally Toolkit Workbook, I talk about the difference between the prophetic voice and the coaching voice. And part of what I think we can do is to bring the prophetic voice, where we're making sharp distinctions and calling problems out and using certain time-tested rhetoric from critical race theory. And if we bring that to Uncle Bubba, that's not only not effective, it's actually counterproductive. And so, but we got to train people how to not do that, as well as how to engage Uncle Bubba in a more effective manner. And I don't see a lot of people thinking about that, at least. So because I didn't see that, I said, well, let me do that. That's what the workbook is trying to do.
Well, I appreciate you drawing the distinction between the different voices that we need to be able to use when we engage in various types of race dialogue, because I think this is an underappreciated point among those of us, frankly, on the left and who do this work. For a long time now, you know, I've sort of vacillated between various roles that I see myself in and that I see others in, and vacillated in terms of my understanding of them and what I think is more important or whatever, but especially trying to figure out how to use each voice in turn. And what I mean by that is, for a long time, I've conceptualized the role of activists of any kind and educators on race or other issues to be separated into three sort of distinct, somewhat overlapping, but also distinct roles. The first of those is the persuasion role. That's sort of what you're talking about with the, you know, the Uncle Bubba conversation, right? Actually taking someone who's on the other side and trying to bring them over to your way of thinking, and to take someone, let's say, who's on the right or relatively conservative, and at least on one particular issue, let's say in this case race, get them to open up and to perhaps change their way of thinking. The second role, a little bit different than the first, is the inoculation role, which is not necessarily, you know, converting the heathen, getting the conservative to suddenly become progressive on this particular issue, but at least neutralizing them and inoculating them against the siren song of the far right. So sometimes, you know, you're not going to be able to get everyone, but at least if you can keep them from becoming an adversary and committing to the far right and going along with what they say, then you've sort of neutralized them, you've taken them out of the picture, and you can focus on your work. And sometimes, you know, that's a small victory, maybe not as big a victory as conversion, but it's still valuable. And that takes a different voice even still. And then the third role is the mobilization role, right? This is the one where you're not really focused on converting people on the right or changing their views, and you've gone beyond the inoculation role. Now you're trying to mobilize your forces. That is to say, to take people who say they're about something and actually get them to go do something. At the most minimal level, that might mean voting in an election, centering racial justice as an issue for candidates. On the greater end of things, it means demonstrating. It means, you know, doing the kinds of activist work that we think of, and we think of movement activity and everything in between those poles of elections and mobilization in the streets. That's really about taking people, let's say progressive, in this case, progressive white folks, who claim to be about something, and maybe they are relatively semi-woke on a lot of different issues, but for whatever reason, perhaps they don't center race, they don't have a clear race analysis for the work they're doing. So maybe they are, you know, environmental activists, or they're people that do work around healthcare or education reform, but they don't do that with a racial lens or an anti-racist frame. Mobilization would mean getting to those folks and getting them active and really doing something. All three of these roles are important, but they all require fundamentally different voices. The voice that I want to use for persuasion is going to be too basic for the people who are already semi-woke. And the voice that I use for the semi-woke folk is going to be far too militant for the people like Uncle Bubba. So I've got to develop, it's a form of bilingual or really multilingualism. It's being able to speak different languages almost.
First of all, I really appreciate, you're always such a refined thinker. I really appreciate talking to you. And I hadn't called out the inoculation function, but I really appreciate you lifting that up as a thing that's important. But as a general matter, I think that what happens is, so the diversity and inclusion industrial complex focuses on the inoculation and the mobilization and not enough on the persuasion. And so people don't know that they need a whole different way of approaching people. And there's a whole different mindset. You're coaching somebody. You're not trying, which is different than what you're doing when you're trying to inoculate them, much less mobilize them.
No, absolutely. And let me be the first to acknowledge, just as a matter of humility, that this is very hard for me. I struggle with this. It is hard for me, and I suspect I'm not the only one, for whom it is difficult to separate sometimes the activist voice, the organizer voice, the movement voice from the educator voice, or what you're referring to as the coach voice, right? Because, you know, when you're doing work for social justice and you know people are suffering under the weight of something like racism or any other system of oppression, it is natural for you to think to yourself, listen, justice is this thing that we've got to get, and we don't have time to wait for your ass to understand and to coach you and to hold your hand. And there's part of me that just rolls my eyes at the very thought of doing that, but that's the activist voice. That's the prophetic movement thing. And yet at the same time, the problem is if you really want to be effective, which if you don't, what the hell are you doing this work for? If you want to be effective, sometimes you have to think pedagogically, right? As a teacher, as an educator, or as you put it, as a coach, as opposed to thinking of it as the motivational speaker and drill sergeant almost, who's trying to mobilize people who are already semi-woke or semi about something. And if you care about effectiveness, you have to think about that. You have to think about how you bring the material, not just how true the material is. It's a question of, you know, do you want to be right or do you want to be effective? And I think sometimes those of us who are activists, we're so committed to being right and so committed to our particular line and our particular analysis and our particular verbiage that we're not necessarily thinking about how that hits people in their ears, so to speak. And if we're not thinking about that, if we're not thinking pedagogically, we're going to be less effective. It's the difference, right, between sort of teaching the grad school seminar where you can hit people with some relatively advanced concepts and going back and saying, wait a minute, maybe today is the day that I need to use the third grade teacher voice, not to be condescending to people, but just to recognize that, you know, there's a certain trajectory of learning and some folk are way back here and they're not necessarily bad people because of that, but they haven't received this material before. And if I'm giving them PhD level shit, they are going to completely tune out, let alone if they think that I'm preaching at them.
Right. And one of the things that happens, I think, in the white ally community is people have a fair amount of shame about like how long it took them to get to where they are, or they have shame that I can't believe my cousin or my brother is still talking like that. Right. And so after they do a certain amount of waking up, then they have shame about how long it took them to do that, or shame that their family members are still like that. And so they turn that shame into unproductive ways of talking to people.
Right.
And they try to shame them out of where they are. And of course, that doesn't work. Right. Right? So that's one. So there's a psychological aspect of that. And then also what can happen is that people feel like, if I'm a woke person, I mean, you get the cultural aspect of this. If you're woke, when somebody says something that's a problem, you're supposed to slam them. And so they got the gaze of other people in their heads when they're interacting with Aunt Martha or Uncle Bubba. They've taught themselves, they've had enough encounters back at the cafe with their hipster homies.
Right.
And what you're supposed to do is this, and that's in their heads. And so they attack at that moment, and that is not productive. There's a certain way in which, I mean, you've heard of the notion of performative wokeness, right?
Oh, yeah.
In these situations, part of the observer's not even in the room. The observers are in their heads, right? You're performing for people who you're going to see tomorrow, right?
Yeah.
Whereas that's not, I mean, you know, I have started to argue, once you know that strategy doesn't work, you're igniting some privilege by keeping doing it. Part of what has to happen is that people have to learn to center themselves. They need to learn to do that before they have an interaction that they think is likely to trigger them, and they need strategies during it. So one of the things that you have seen is that in the core, if we want to call it technology, of the White Ally Toolkit is something called the RACE method. And RACE stands for reflect, ask, connect, expand. And that has to do with how you manage a conversation and shift it from a conversation that's about a battle of opinions to a conversation that's about sharing experiences. But that first part, reflect, is a critical thing to engage, to actually engage in all of that and stay strategic. You have to calm down. You have to reflect. You have to, even before the encounter happens, you need to know, what are the things that I can do for myself in order to stay in a centered place? And then when the encounter starts happening, you need to take a moment to do that. So yeah, so Uncle Bubba says something, you might need to, maybe you can take a breath and deal with it. Or maybe you need to say, Uncle Bubba, you know, that's really interesting. I'll be right back, and go to the bathroom and center yourself there. Get their whole thing together. Okay, what do I need to remember to do to stay calm? How am I going to focus on connecting with this person? What am I going to ask this person? How am I going to, you know, because ask them about their experiences. So they move away from a conversation about beliefs, because by doing that, you calm them down. And also you fire up your own mirror neurons, right, that help you connect with them if they're telling a story as opposed to telling you some belief. But you have to be willing, you have to be in a position to listen to that. And that's why you got to calm down first. But then after you ask them to talk about their experiences related to what they said that you found problematic, then even the harder task is to try to connect to them. You're trying to further build rapport and tell them a story that, as one of my comrades say, you want to find the chocolate in the trail mix. So they say something off the wall. They say that, you know, people shouldn't be complaining about the police because everybody knows if you act right, cops treat you fairly. And of course, what they're really saying, why are those Negroes acting like that? Like, you don't believe in their statement, but you do believe there are good cops out there. That's the chocolate within that trail mix, is that there are good cops out there. Or you do believe that what you do in a cop encounter has effect on the cops. So that's maybe the chocolate in the trail mix. So what you want to do is to tell them a story, a personal story. It's something that relates to something they said, and that's the connect step. And that's before you try to expand their thinking by telling them another personal story that basically tells them race and racism are real. We need to think about it. Right. But people want to go right to expand and not even through a personal story. Right. They skip over relaxing, reflect. They skipped over asking, they skipped over connecting, and they go right to expand and don't even do that in a personal story. And is it surprising that we get the kind of backlash we get?
Well, you know, it reminds me, I was last Thanksgiving or shortly before, I was out in Denver for some talks, and I was speaking at Regis University out there in Denver, and a number of students asked me questions either during the Q&A or afterward that were one or another variation on a theme. And the theme was basically, you know, I'm going home for Thanksgiving, and I've got this really racist uncle, and I need to know how to talk to him when he says crazy stuff. And of course, it's always, I should point out for the listeners, you know, it's always, notice, the racist uncle. No one ever has a racist father, apparently, or mother, or auntie, or cousin. It's always the uncle who shows up and ruins Thanksgiving, apparently. But they all had a story like this, and they all wanted to know, how do I talk to that person? What do I say to them when they start spouting some racist nonsense about immigration or whatever it is? And first I started off by saying, well, let me tell you what not to say, because sometimes that's the better beginning place, right? I said, first of all, do not break out your intersectional feminist theory 101 textbook on them.
Snap, snap, brother. Exactly.
You know, and I should point out, it wasn't because that stuff isn't good. Like, I wasn't saying don't bust that out because it's not good stuff. I happen to believe in that stuff and think it's very important. But what I was trying to say was, you know, your uncle ain't ready for that yet. Maybe we can get him there at some point, but that is not going to happen around turkey and dressing, you know, at Thanksgiving. So you have to use a different approach. And although I didn't think of it in the terms that you put it, the race method, as you've described it, the RACE, I did at least have enough foresight to point out the importance of asking questions as opposed to responding to some nonsense with declarative statements, right? And what I explained to the students there are two reasons why the asking questions piece, the inquiry piece, as opposed to the declarative demonstrative statement piece, is so important. First of all, it shows a certain degree of respect, right? It says to that person, I care about what you think and how you're feeling, so explain this to me. And sometimes, you know, a little respect will go a long way. But then in addition to that, on a practical level, you need to know why your uncle or your classmate or your roommate or your coworker or whoever it is saying the stuff that they're saying that is so problematic. Because if you don't understand the place from which they're coming, you don't necessarily know what it is that you need to say or how you need to respond, because the motivation is going to in some ways determine your response. Let's say your uncle is saying some really, you know, horribly racist stuff about Black folks or Mexican Americans or, you know, Islamophobic stuff about Muslims rooted in some particular isolated personal experience they've had from which they are falsely extrapolating and generalizing now to the entire group. Okay, if that's where they're coming from, you need to know that, because that will lead you to say certain things or maybe tell certain stories that would help to respond to that or to counter that, that would be effective or helpful. But if they're not coming from a place of personal experience, let's say they're just, you know, parroting something they heard on Fox or something that went around in a viral email that's sort of secondhand, that's going to require a different kind of response than the one that's rooted in personal experience. So you want to ask questions so that you can probe a little more deeply into where the person's coming from. That's going to help you be more effective right there, as well as give you some time to center yourself, going back to what you said with the R, the reflect part of the race method.
Yeah. Excellent. That's exactly right. So you have to ask. First of all, just having them talk about their experience, you produce a different tone in the interaction in the first place. And so what I tell people to do in response to the common question I get, which is, what if when you ask them a question, they start talking about Fox News, they start talking about stuff that Sean Hannity said or whatever. And so one of the things I suggest that people do, sometimes you have to put some energy into moving them off of that. So you might say something like this. Well, that's really great that you're such a good media consumer. That's fantastic. You get a lot of information. But I find that there's, you know, one of the things that affects me more is that when people tell me something that happened in their personal experience, and I bet you've had some experience that relates to that. Otherwise, you wouldn't think that was true, because you know there's a lot of bad media out there. So you flip it around on them and dig deeper, because I'm not saying everybody's had a bad experience, but they have had some experience that they have interpreted, however spuriously, to align with what they're learning.
Right.
And by shifting the conversation to what they have experienced, you're in a much better position to create rapport. But I think that you are exactly right. I need to get that quote from you, because you cited this quote that, like, in 1965, some really huge portion of white people thought there was no racial problem. I need to get that reference from you, because I find that augments my discussion of the level of denial in the white population and what we're fighting.
What you're talking about is something that I've had in my stock presentation and all iterations of my speeches for well over a decade. It's one of the few things that I leave in. I do it very deliberately because I do think it's very helpful in framing the issue of white privilege, particularly when it comes to obliviousness about non-white reality. And also it's very helpful for engaging in dialogue like what we're talking about, asking questions to try to find out where people are. The piece that you're referring to, there's a Gallup poll that was taken back in 1963, and they did a poll where they asked a large representative cross sample of white Americans what, you know, in retrospect is a very easy question. The question was, do you believe that blacks are treated equally in your community in housing, employment, and education? Now, obviously, with a half century in the rearview mirror, right, we all know that the answer to that is, well, of course not. Black folks weren't treated equally. That's before the Civil Rights Acts were even on the books. Voting Rights Act of 65, Fair Housing Act of 68, and of course, the original Civil Rights Act of 64. 1963 is a high watermark for the civil rights movement. It's the year of the March on Washington, you know. So obviously the answer is no. And yet in 1963, when Gallup asked that question, approximately two-thirds, I think it was 64% of white Americans answered in the affirmative. They basically said everything's fine. And that's in spite of the fact that literally every night being beamed into their living rooms via the three network television stations that existed at the time, which were being watched by virtually everyone tuned into Walter Cronkite or whomever, seeing these images of profoundly unequal treatment. I mean, clearly we were a formal white supremacist society, a formal apartheid nation at the time. And yet, you know, two out of three white folks didn't see it. 1962, a year before that poll, Gallup asked another question of white folks. They said, do you think black children have the same chance to get a good quality education equal to the quality that white children can receive, or something along those lines? And 87%, almost 9 out of 10 white folks asked that question, answered in the affirmative. This was only 8 years after Brown v. Board, but it's obviously well before any school system in this country had truly moved to implement the strictures of Brown and to get rid of separate and unequal. And so the answer is obviously no. And in retrospect, you ask anybody today about 1962 and whether schooling was equal, and they're going to say, of course not. They're going to say that whether they're liberal or conservative, right, left, or anywhere in between. But in 1962, almost 9 out of 10 white folks looked at that and thought there was no problem. The reason I always use that is it's a way to use a data point. It's a way to use a fact, but to use a fact in the context of a question rather than a declarative statement. Because once I present that fact, the question I ask people is, you know, tell me, what do you think that means? What does it mean that even when racism was blatant in this country, I mean, absolutely blatant and formal, what does it mean that otherwise decent people, which is something I believe most white folks are, I believe most people are decent folks, what does it mean that otherwise decent people could look out at society at a time when it was formal white supremacy and not see it? Because the only answer that I can come up with is that white folks had the privilege then, and I would say still do, of being oblivious to black and brown truth, so decent people could still miss it because you don't have to know any better. You know, you don't have to know what people are experiencing. You have the luxury of remaining behind a veil of ignorance. And so when I ask that question, I'm real curious, what do you think it means? And then what do you think it means for white Americans today? The premise of that question obviously being, listen, if we didn't notice it and didn't get it when it was obvious and blatant and legal for this racism and this discrimination to happen, is it possible that maybe we're missing something today? Is it possible that we're still overlooking other people's reality? And I do find that works to open up some conversations, because even though you're using a fact, you're doing it in sort of a non-declarative, inquisitive way that opens up the conversation rather than tries to shut it down. What other methods, what other techniques have you seen in your work that help similar to that to open up dialogue?
One of the things that I'm, as the project grows, is one of the things that I want to do is more experimentation like that about what works. But what you're talking about, what you're raising is, what is an on-ramp to a productive conversation? Yeah. And how do we construct that on-ramp? I think that what we need to do is to start these larger scale experiments where people try different ways of opening up a conversation. One of the things that I have a partnership with a group called, it's just at the very beginning, called SMART. SMART stands for Social Media Approaches for Radical Transformation. And they have a Facebook thing called SMART Politics. And that they are all about trying to have people, progressives, engage more productively with conservatives online. Now, and they got like 7,000 followers, and it's really great work. Yeah. I'm more concerned about face-to-face interaction. Yeah. So we're starting a little thing called the ACT Smart Lab. Like, ACT is Ally Conversation Toolkit, which is the other name of my project called the White Ally Toolkit, or Ally Conversation Toolkit, or ACT. And so what we're trying to do is to get people who are interested in, like, experiments in how you engage across the ideological divides. So one of the things I think we need to think about, if we're really trying to move forward on racism, we need these larger scale experiments using a certain level big data and people going out and trying different approaches to engage, to create productive dialogue and seeing what happens. What I'm trying to get people to do is to use the methods that I have described, which are based on conflict resolution. They're based on neurobiology. They're based on persuasion science. Right. And my challenge is to figure out a way to get more people to try these things, right, and then report back. So one of the things that I am launching by the end of this month is a subscriber page where that's all about these kind of interactions. And also what I'm going to do starting on Tuesday is to put people through like a free boot camp where they would do a little 20-minute task every day to try to gradually teach them these processes. And so if you go to Facebook page, White Ally Toolkit, then off of that, there's an event called the Connection Trumps Conflict 28-Day Boot Camp. I'm going to be giving people a little instruction every day. And over the course, in the run-up to the election, they will learn additional skills, which not only there will be about race, but this translates to other issues. Part of why I think that we all need to think about, and we do this kind of race work, is that racism is such an important problem, but we have arguably a bigger problem. Yeah. And that is, we're so ideologically divided that our enemies are using it against us.
Right.
Right. They're fomenting divisions so that, and these divisions are, you know, some serious people like Jonathan Haidt, you know, the Righteous Mind. I saw him last week. He was like, I'm less confident that the U.S. in its current form will be around in 50 years than I ever have been. So we need to think about how we are dealing with these divisions in society and in our families, because, you know, the current trends are not positive.
Well, one of the things that struck me in the toolkit workbook as I was going through it, there seems to be, if I'm reading it correctly, you make the point in there that in some of the dialogue sessions that you have been involved with, the more conservative folks in the room, the people who maybe we on the left see as adversaries, or even if we're having a really shitty day as enemies, that when we engage them in this kind of dialogic process that isn't rooted in judgmentalism or, you know, beating them over the head with our position, but really trying to engage and have a conversation, that they apparently also seem really heartened by the fact that people on the left want to talk with them, want to have a conversation, and that they're very open to that, that they are also apparently very concerned about the level of division in the country. And that's something that we also need to understand. Am I reading that correctly?
That is exactly right. Part of what we have to own up to as progressive people is we can have a whole, there is progressive intolerance. And I think that we need to look at that seriously. I mean, in fact, I was talking to Debbie Irving, the woman who wrote Waking Up White.
Yeah.
And I met her a couple weeks ago, and she flipped it in an interesting way. She said, part of what I think is happening is that one of the core components of white supremacy is othering people, is making some people less than others. And what we have to think about is, are there people who are on the left and progressive who do that othering to people on the right with the intention of people's liberation? You're actually using the master's tools. You're actually using techniques that are part of the regime you're trying to undermine, and ultimately they're not effective. So I thought that was an interesting way of flipping that. On a basic level, like, compassion is compassion. Right. Dignity is dignity, right? So people sense when you are not treating them with respect and dignity, you're looking down on them, you're condescending to them. People know that. Part of what I try to tell people in the project is you're not trying to be Barry Bonds or Babe Ruth or Hank Aaron hitting home runs. When you're trying to be Rod Carew and Pete Rose,
trying
to get a whole bunch of singles and doubles. And right. So part of what people, out of some sense of a lack of skill and that whole performative wokeness thing I talked about earlier, part of what people are trying to do is they're trying to, like, deliver the soliloquy and drop the mic and walk away from the conversation as if that's going to solve things. They're trying to hit a home run. And, you know, that tends not to work.
That is where the neurobiology piece that you talk about in the toolkit comes in. So I want you to talk a little bit about that, because I find that stuff fascinating. And it's one of the things that makes me wish I had paid closer attention, like in psychology class, or that I had studied science more just in general. Because what I understand from the neuroscience is it's really scary, but it's also informative and instructive. And as long as we understand it, we don't have to be afraid of it. We can move forward with it. The first is that we don't come to our political, philosophical, and ideological opinions primarily from facts or logic, right? It's not because we've sat down and looked at all the available evidence and then concluded that X, Y, or Z is true. It's mostly that we come to that stuff through emotions and through narratives and through personal experiences from which we have derived a particular meaning that may or may not be accurate, may or may not comport with what the facts actually say, but in our mind it does. And then the second frightening thing is that when you're talking to someone who's on the other side of one of those particularly deeply held opinions, it's not necessarily true with every issue, but if it's a deeply held opinion that's connected to their overall worldview, when you try to bring facts to them to try to change their mind, those facts don't typically work. And in fact, they can make people double down even more.
So I'll break it down. I'll try to break it down really quickly. The most important thing is to consider there's something called the backfire effect. And the backfire effect is a result of what you said, which is that our sense of identity, our deeply held beliefs, we can think of them as they're like a castle that has a moat, and there's animals in the moat that can be activated or not. There's turrets on the castle, and they can have gunners that can be positioned or not. And so when we get information that is threatening our sense of identity or threatening deeply held beliefs, what happens is that we put the little chum in the moat to get the alligators fired up. We send the archers to the turrets because we're getting ready for battle. And so if we're trying to challenge people's views about race, views about race are linked to people's views about their own group. Yeah. And so when we start to challenge that, we activate the parts of our brain that are the same parts that are activated when we are under physical threat. So part of what we're trying to do is to have people relax, not have people fired up. But when, because people are not relaxed, you get something called the backfire effect. And the backfire effect basically is when people are confronted with information that challenges their beliefs, they basically double down on their beliefs, no matter how good the information is. And so, you know, we can thank Mr. Trump for creating a phrase, fake news, to now people can all just think, oh, that's fake news, right? They have a phrase to reject it. But the backfire effect has been known about for maybe 20, 30 years. And so, and by the way, conservatives do that no more than liberals do it. Everybody listening to this show is just as subject to the backfire effect as people listen to Sean Hannity. But what you want to do is to move away from overwhelming people with facts, because the facts will simply fire up the backfire effect. Now, the good news is that there's other parts of our brain that tend to help with help make dialogue engagement a more effective strategy. And one of those things I mentioned earlier is mirror neurons. There's a part of also our brain that is attuned to feeling things that other people feel, we think other people feel. Right. So this is why yawning is contagious. This is why laughter is contagious. This is why tears are contagious. That's because of mirror neurons. There's a part of our brain that when we're engaged, like it syncs up with what we think the other person is experiencing. So what you want to do is to fire that up, both in them and you. And that is why, as I mentioned earlier, that's why you ask a question. Like when somebody says something that you think is crazy and you're going to pursue it, it is a dialogue moment. You ask them a question. You try to get them to go beneath the belief to the experience that drives the belief. So thus you're firing up your mirror neurons. But also, that sometimes getting people to tell their own story, it helps them revisit the conclusions they've come to. You can't bank on that, but sometimes that happens. There's an additional thing that is in play here too, which is called the reciprocity principle. And that is when you do something nice for somebody, there's a part of us that knows I should do something nice for them that's similar. And, you know, we've all seen that with invitations and gifts and all that. It also applies to listening. The point of asking people is that you have them, you listen to them first. You offer yourself as a listener and you get them to talk. And there's a part of them that knows they should listen to you too. That's why the next step is you tell them a story, but you don't try to expand their view. You try to connect with them and you leverage reciprocity principle to get them to listen to your story. But you do that in a connecting way before you flip it. Yeah. And then you tell them another story that will challenge their thinking. But that doing all that requires like presence and consciousness and calm and centeredness. And so if you haven't done that reflexive at the beginning, you might not be able to do all that. We don't train people to have different rhetorical palettes. Part of what goes on between interaction between allies and skeptics is that the ally behavior is our tone, our wanting to nail people down on, you got to talk about racism is this, white supremacy is that, you have to believe that, is part of what goes on is that people are reacting to you. They're not reacting to the issue. Part of the trick is to be centered enough and be strategic enough that you're teeing up the issue. You're not making them react to you.
Right. And let me give you an example, because it's something that I've learned over the years that I had to do as an in to having this conversation with people who were harder cases, the people who were not where I needed them to be yet. And not so much in a, you know, in a big lecture hall, but like in a smaller workshop type session where you're really trying to use that more persuasive voice with people. One of the things that I had to do was adjust the sort of dogmatic and reflexive approach that I sometimes, I think, early on deployed in my reaction to things that people would say. So back in the day, a long time ago now, but back in the day, I think if I was in one of those sessions and someone did, you know, like the typical white deflection move, right, which is we're talking about racism and we're talking about white privilege or white supremacy, and the white person deflects to the fact that they grew up poor or working class and how hard that was, or they deflect to sexism and misogyny because they're white women and they talk about that, or they're Jewish as I am and they want to talk about anti-Semitism as a way to get out of perhaps their whiteness and the privilege that comes with that, or to get out of, you know, talking about the oppression of other people. They sort of switch it to themselves. And I think back in the day, well, I know from experience that my mentality, whether I would have said it this way or not, my mentality would have been, yeah, whatever, stop deflecting, stop trying to hijack the conversation, we got to get back on track. And I probably would have given it very short shrift because I saw it as a deflection technique. What I've learned is, even if it is a deflection technique, and I think it is the majority of the time, I've learned that I have to let you have that victory. I'm going to let you have that win for the minute. I'm going to give you the victory. I'm going to let you speak your piece about that. I'm going to give you that 3, 4, 5 minutes to talk about the pain you experience because of class subordination or gender and sex subordination or subordination on the basis of your sexuality or your religion or your disability or whatever it is. Because what I've learned is if I give you that couple of minutes, couple things. Number one, it's just a decent, compassionate thing to do because that shit is real. Like, people are oppressed on the basis of other things than just race. And so if you have been harmed and damaged and marginalized, a decent human being, which I'm trying to be, is going to let you articulate that because that pain is real and needs to be heard. Secondly, I need to let you have the win on that and give you that opening because that becomes a bridge that I can then use to bring you back to where I need you to be. So if I give you that 4 or 5 minutes or 2-3 minutes to talk about class subordination or gender subordination or whatever it is, it's going to be easier for me to come back to you and say, yeah, first of all, I'm really sorry that you had that experience. And, you know, me being Jewish, I can actually share maybe very briefly a couple similar experiences that I've had growing up, you know, Jewish in Nashville. And then that allows me to say to that person, you know, and I bet that if someone in this room, in reaction to what you just shared with us, were to respond by saying, oh, come on, it wasn't that bad. Right? Or, you know, maybe you're exaggerating, or maybe you're misinterpreting what happened, or, you know, maybe it wasn't really sexism, or maybe it wasn't really classism, or maybe it wasn't really anti-Semitism, right? You'd probably be upset and offended by the way I was dismissing you or the way someone else was. And of course, the answer they would have to offer at that moment is yes. And that allows me to then say, okay, well, by the same token, right? That's how people of color sometimes feel or usually feel when we who are white sort of dismiss their concerns about racism or claim that they're exaggerating or claim that they're not interpreting their own lived experience in the proper and accurate way. It actually becomes a bridge between their pain and the pain that I'm trying to get them to focus on. But it took a long time for me to understand that that was an important adaptation in my own rhetorical strategy that I had to make if I wanted to bring people in.
So I am totally with that. And I just think that part of what we have to do is to figure out sort of at the almost level of memes, which is why I tried to create like the race method. You need to remember, how do we package these kind of somewhat complex concepts in ways that people can easily learn and deploy, which is the, I think, the challenge for the field and a challenge that we haven't taken up. And some we haven't taken up is because we haven't, some of it is just an attention issue.
Right.
Like people,
right.
You know, if we get more people thinking about the problem of propagating dialogue skills through the population and through the white population specifically, maybe we can come up with some better tools. We have to figure out this sort of almost like the marketing of it, the dissemination challenges of people doing that. And we have not invested in that task. Some of what this project is headed for is, you know, giving away some of this, giving away some of these approaches and resources, but also like having automated tools that people can like go up a ladder of allyship and become more effective. Yeah. And ultimately, I mean, so that's, I'm trying to figure out how to get social investors and philanthropy to buy into that.
No, I know exactly what you mean. It's almost like gamifying the process of allyship in a way.
That is exactly right. Like my fantasy is that there'll be teams of people learning this material and then actually saying, okay, let's look at, you know, this team in Nashville versus a team in Louisville. We're all, how many people, we're going to try to have a 6-month process to gamify who are we influencing? Right. And you get a certain amount of points if you get somebody to read an article, but more points you get them to go watch 13, more points or whatever. You got to set that up, right?
Yeah.
But in order, the gamification of social change is part of what we need to do. And so, but so what I'm trying to do is to get enough kind of followers and fans and people into this project so that I can start thinking about that. I don't think we don't think about this like that.
No, we absolutely don't. And I actually have a sort of firsthand experience and a story to share with you about that. Several years ago now, it's been like 3, I was on a cruise ship put together by this group called the Summit Community. And they do these cruises every year, every other year, sort of like TED Talk in the Sea, where you get all these folks together from a lot of different backgrounds. You get a lot of activist people, there are media people, there are corporate people, there are, you know, health and wellness people, and there's a bunch of folks, frankly, from Silicon Valley, a lot of quote-unquote thought leaders in a lot of different areas. And the folks at Summit wanted me to come on. I've talked about this on the show before and sort of joked about it. They wanted me to come on and do a presentation about white privilege on this cruise ship, which when someone says you want to talk about white privilege on a cruise ship, I mean, the only and not at all ironic answer is, of course. So I go and I do this. and did this talk about white privilege. When I was done, I had a bunch of folks coming up to me who were not activists. That was not where the world they were in. These were Silicon Valley folks. These were app designers. These were tech people. And I had several of them coming up to me saying, hey, you know what we need is an app where we could track, it could be used in schools or whatever, and it would allow you to track your privilege, come up with some type of like privilege score, and then it would offer you various recommendations of ways that you could spend your quote unquote privilege dollars, if you will, in a constructive way. And there was part of me at the time that like my head just, I couldn't get my head around this. I thought, oh geez, what is this? You know, this is like some bullshit. And because it's not my world. I just didn't really, I mean, it was intriguing, but I was also sort of rolling my eyes. But then the more I thought about it, the more I realized, okay, just because that's not coming out of the world I'm used to, let's think it through, right? If getting young people in particular in schools who are very tech focused, very app focused, do everything on their phones, to have some kind of an app where as part of an educational tool, they would answer a series of questions, sort of like what we do when we have workshops and we have people do privilege walks, which I think sometimes are problematic for reasons I won't get into here, but you ask questions, right? And people take a step forward or a step backward based on how they answer the question. It'd be like that, but it would be technological and much more private. You answer the questions, you see your score, and it could be around race, gender, sexuality, class, whatever. And then rather than just like having the awareness, all of a sudden, you know, you look at your score and there's a series of recommendations about things that are going on in the community that you could get involved in as a way to, you know, not necessarily balance the scales per se, but as a way to spend your privilege in a constructive way. And however simplistic we may think that sounds, and again, that's a thumbnail sketch of what they were saying to me, but the concept I think is very important. If you can figure out a way in this modern technological society to gamify both the issue of awareness and gamify the issue of action and make it something that people engage in on that level, I think a lot of younger people in particular are going to be attracted to that. And we can sit and gnash our teeth and be upset about that. And, you know, we can wish that everybody would just do it old school and organize the way they did 20 and 30 and 50 years ago. But the truth is we live in a different world and we have to adapt and learn to use some of those new tools.
That is exactly right. We're trying to foster a social innovation. What we're trying to do is to work on a 400-year problem that is still driving a significant amount of our collective social problems, much less is just unfair. We're trying to fight that, and we're trying to do so in a culture that is not only riven by social divisions, but people are inundated with all sorts of information, and they got all sorts of priorities in their world. So I think that we have to think in terms of marketing and virality and all those things that have to do with how you get trends to happen, how you get people engaging in things in ways that they didn't necessarily buy into at first, but they thought it was an advantage to them, but ultimately is an advantage to the collective for them to do it and to tell other people about that. And how do we do that that doesn't make everybody have to have a certain ideology? I think that part of what has to happen is that if we're really going to move white folks, we cannot expect them all to become liberals. We have to envision that there could be an anti-racist conservatism, even if we've never seen an anti-racist conservative. And I think there's parts of conservatism that are inherently, I don't know if they're inherently racist, but it's harder for conservative people to be anti-racist because of the nature of conservatism, but it's not impossible. Part of what we have to deal with is we're trying to help people become more effective in conveying the message to get other white folks out of racism denial is that you can do that and still be a conservative.
Well, and we can't be afraid to make common cause with people on one or two or three issues just because there's a whole set of other issues where we have some profound disagreements. You know, I can remember back in the 80s when I was, like a lot of people at that time, involved in Central American peace and solidarity work around Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, and U.S. foreign policy within Central America and Latin America, that some of the folks that we worked with very closely in that movement were the Catholic peace and justice community. A lot of nuns, a lot of priests, a lot of Catholic laypersons as well, who were very devout and very, very good on issues of war and peace and militarism and imperialism, and also on the issue of the nuclear freeze in the early to mid 80s as well, when that was a real big issue. And yet there were some people in the coalitions that I was a part of, again, people very committed, hardened leftists, who steadfastly just either refused to work with or constantly griped about having to work with the Catholic peace and justice community because, oh my God, they're anti-abortion and you know, they don't allow women to be priests and they don't, you know, and all of these things. things. And I totally understood all of that. And I'm, you know, militantly in favor of reproductive self-determination for all persons. But the idea that you're not going to work with people who are putting their lives on the line, literally as many nuns and priests were throughout Central America, just because of that issue seems incredibly short-sighted. There's time for us to work on those other issues. There's time for me to have that conversation with you around abortion, but I'm never going to be able to have that conversation with you if I don't have a relationship with you. And I'm never going to have a relationship with you if I'm not willing to work with you from the beginning. Like, if I work with you on this one thing that we can find some commonality on, then we start to have a relationship. Now I can forge some deeper understanding, and then I can sit down and have that conversation. But I'm never going to get there if I refuse to sit at the table with you in the first place.
Right. If I'm trying to talk to Uncle Bubba, and I'm trying to get him out of, you know, what if he's both racist and sexist and homophobic?
Right.
I might have to make choices about which of those isms that he buys into that I'm fighting this year. Because if I'm trying to fight them all at once, he will justifiably feel his whole worldview is being attacked. And that's actually true. So there's the level of the coalition, but there's also the level of, like, as I'm talking to people in my circle, yes, I can be all intersectional and think about that and think these things are all related. But from an influence standpoint, I might not want to bring all of that up.
Well, or I would argue you do want to bring it up, but you want to bring it up in a way that isn't going to overwhelm the person to whom you're speaking. I mean, let's be honest, intersectionality as a concept is one that even people who are pretty committed left and progressive folks are still struggling with in some cases, trying to get their head around and make their work intersectional as it needs to be. If that has been hard, if that has been a learning curve for committed progressives who've been working either on race or gender or sexuality or class or whatever it is, now having to blend all those things, imagine how much more difficult it's going to be for Uncle Bubba, who's on the wrong side of all of those things. So it isn't that we want to not use an intersectional analysis, but once again, it's about pedagogically, how do I roll out this notion of intersectionality? And might I need to start with one of these today? And then as we build some rapport and as we build some trust and as we build some real connection around that issue, now I can start to unfold the process by which you connect those things to those other things. And then we are going to get, in other words, to intersectionality, but that's not the 101 level. Listen, I know that I have kept you well over time, longer than I said I was going to. It's been a great conversation. Before we go, though, on this episode, if you could do me a big favor, let folks know the way that they can get this White Ally Toolkit workbook online, what the website is, how they can access it, social media information, how to get in touch, all of that.
Sure. So the website is AllyConversationToolkit.com. But if White Ally Toolkit is easy to remember, it's the same website. So WhiteAllyToolkit.com and AllyConversationToolkit.com is the same website. One of the things I will say briefly is that last year I published a brief webinar, which you can get on the, it's a $10 webinar called the Connection Trumps Conflict Holiday Survive and Thrive Guide. And so basically it's designed to be a little half hour webinar about some strategies for having conversations about current issues around the Thanksgiving table and doing so in a way that's more dialogic and less likely to cause divisions. But the main thing is the workbook. And the workbook is a 300-page document. It's $24.95, and it's called the White Ally Toolkit Workbook. And to your listeners or their friends, there is a discount code that lasts until October the 15th. And so the discount code is called ACTWISE20. So they get 20% off on the workbook. It's a 300-page document. It has a whole bunch of reflective tools. It has strategies for how you deal with 8 specific racism-denying statements, like I'm colorblind and unconscious bias doesn't exist, to white privilege doesn't exist, to those people are lazy, and if they just worked hard, they'd work on their problems. So there's all that, because I want people to be capable of responding to things that come up in the moment. And so there's a curriculum where you start out, you make a good choice where you start. You don't start out with structural racism if you're trying to upgrade somebody's understanding. Yeah. Maybe start out with othering. So there's a whole curriculum of how you take people up a ladder of understanding using the same principles at the core of the race method. And then there's some additional exercises and commentary at the front and back of the book that are useful, including what is our bias against conservative people and how do we get in touch with that? And conservatism is not just, it's not just an ideological question. It's like a lifestyle orientation. So I build on some of the work by Jonathan Haidt in that. And then also I'm implementing a subscriber channel where people can talk about, I tried this. What happened with you? Why would you try that? So I'm inviting people to get that. And again, a discount at the ActWise 20, which is 20% off the book for your listeners or people that want to pass that on to. And that is active until October the 15th at midnight.
And that'll do it for this episode of Speak Out with Tim Wise. If you're interested in contacting David and finding out more about the White Ally Toolkit workbook, you can check him out on Twitter at The Dialogue Guy or on Facebook under White Ally Toolkit, or of course at the website whiteallytoolkit.com. I highly recommend that you check out the workbook, you download it. It is an incredible resource. I'm going through it right now, and there's a lot of really good strategic advice for people out there who are trying to not only put together organized and formal dialogue sessions, but also simply for one-on-one conversations with friends, with colleagues, or with family. And follow the show on Facebook at Speak Out with Tim Wise, on Twitter at Speak Out Tim Wise, as well as on Instagram.